The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm director of author events here, and I'm very pleased to welcome our three authors this evening. So despite the air conditioning in this auditorium, the weather outside provides a perfect backdrop for the three novels that we'll learn about tonight, which take us from the jungles of Brazil to early 20th century Yemen and on to New Jersey by way of Greece. Moving forward in alphabetical order, our first presenter, Nomi Eve, has been called a storyteller of uncommon energy and poise. Eve is the author of the National Jewish Book Award nominated The Family Orchard, the decade-spanning story of a family whose fortunes ebb and flow with the creation and evolution of the Israeli state. Her stories and essays have appeared in the New York Times and Glimmer Train, and she currently directs the Drexel University Story Lab. Eve's new novel, Henna House, portrays the life of a young woman living in a mid-20th century community of Yemenite Jews. If you've been keeping up with the news, you know that Nomi was on a quest to take the novel to 100 book clubs, a number she blew through many weeks ago. Tonight, I believe we clock in at number 126? Okay. In Annie Leontis's Let Me Explain You, great title, the patriarch of a Greek family who believes he has only one day to live sends a scathing email to his ex-wife and three grown daughters. It's an ingenious start to a hilarious first novel the New York Times describes as less like reading than a book than renting a room in someone's brain, a room boisterous with moving bodies, food smells, noises. It's a festive place to visit. Leontis' numerous stories and poems have appeared in Ninth Letter, Night Train, and Lit. She is the recipient of a Barbara Deming Memorial Fund grant and will begin teaching at Bryn Mawr in the fall. Our final presenter will be Victoria Shore. Award-winning critic and author John Lahr calls Shore's debut novel a dashing and vivid and lyrical take on the legendary outlaw and his paramour. In Backlands, the real-life yet nearly mythical Limpiao and Maria Bonita, the Robin Hood and Maid Marian of Brazil, travel their country's shifting 20th century landscapes amid emotional and cultural upheavals. Together, they would become the most celebrated and wanted folk heroes in Brazilian history. In a starred review, Donna Siemens writes, "Shore astutely and lyrically illuminates the mythological, psychological, and social dimensions of the bandit lovers' lives, portraying them both as poignantly complex and besieged individuals and archetypal warriors, ardently defending wildness in all its embodiments." In addition to her writing, Shore is currently working to establish a college prep school on a Native American reservation. Please welcome our first presenter, Nomi Eve.
This is such a beautiful podium. I think it's the prettiest podium I've ever spoken at. It's pretty. People always ask me what my book is about. They're always asking for a taste of the plot, the story, the heart of the matter. I could be walking in the grocery store. People will say, "Nomi, what's your book about?" They want to know, you know, what's the plot? I answer by explaining that Henna House tells the story of Adela Damari, a Jewish woman born in a small village in the Kingdom of North Yemen in 1918. I explain that Adela narrates the book, looking back on her life and telling a story of love and forgiveness, a tale of people she loved and lost a lifetime ago. I explain that central to Adela's life is something called the Orphan's Decree. The Orphan's Decree was an oppressive law in the Kingdom of North Yemen. The law stated that any Jewish child whose father died would be confiscated by the Muslim authorities, adopted into a Muslim family, and converted to Islam. confiscated Jewish children would never see their own families again. In order to thwart the law and protect their children, the Jews of the Kingdom of North Yemen came up with an ingenious plan. They engaged and married off their children as children, because married children were not confiscated. In my novel, Henna House, Adela's father is sickly, and she is at risk of confiscation from the time she is born. Here is what Adela has to say about the confiscator and about how her fear of him shapes her life story. "I have done a great deal of thinking about this matter," she says, "about where to begin a story that ends with blood and sacrifice. At last, I have come to believe that my story begins on the day the confiscator came to my father's shop for the first time. This man, the monster of my childhood, the ghost who haunts my dreams, cast the same shadow as all the other predators who have hounded my people since the dawn of time. Different men, they are all descendants of the same darkness." The confiscator comes into Adela's father's shop at the very beginning of the book, and she is not free of her fear of him for many pages. When people ask me about my book, I tell them about the orphan's decree, about the confiscator, and I explain how, as a very young child, Adela is engaged to a cousin for protection from confiscation. But the engagement is broken, and Adela is at risk once more. Whom Adela falls in love with, whom she's engaged to a second time, also for protection, whom she eventually marries, is what my book is about. Henna House is also about how Adela and her family ultimately leave their homes as a consequence of drought, poverty, and oppression. They walk down through the mountains, enduring an incredible journey. They're heading to the southern port city of Aden, where they will eventually board planes chartered in secret by the young Israeli government to fly the entire Jewish community of Yemen to Israel. This incredible and very real mission was called Operation Magic Carpet, and it is an essential chapter in Yemenite Jewish history, and it is also an important part of my book. People ask me what my book is about, and I tell them what I just told you, that it is about Adela Damari, about the orphan's decree, Operation Magic Carpet, etc., etc., etc. But a novel doesn't just have a story, right? A novel also has a soul. No one usually stops me in the grocery store and asks me about the soul of my book, but I wish that they would. If they would, I would tell them that the soul of my book is henna. When I speak of henna, I am referring to this, what I have on my hand. I can show you up close later on. I'm talking about the elaborate designs that women draw on their skin using the crushed leaf of the henna plant. I don't know about you, but I had no idea that Jews did henna. I thought that henna was purely an Indian art. And when I was doing my research for this book into the culture and history of Yemenite Jews, I was fascinated to learn that all the Jews of the Arab lands have their own precious henna life cycle rituals. When I learned about henna, I was instantly smitten. Henna is so beautiful, of course, but it's also a female art and heritage passed down from mother to daughter in a time and place where women were denied an education. My character, Adela, begins the book illiterate. Like her mother and aunties and sister-in-laws, none of the females in the Kingdom of North Yemen were taught to read and write. As a writer, I grew interested in the way that henna gave women a way to pass down knowledge and to leave a mark, even if it wasn't a permanent one. My narrator, Adela Damari, comes from a family of very talented henna artists. Her aunt was a professional, often hired to decorate brides for their weddings. Adela's cousin, Hani, has the lore and love of henna at her fingertips. And it is Hani who teaches Adela the art of henna. And it is also Hani who teaches Adela how to read and write. Here is what Adela has to say about learning henna and the incredible effect it has on her life. I marveled at how a single line or dot, replicated with artistry and expertise, could create a design so intricate. Learning how to apply henna made me look at the world differently. Where before I had seen pebbles, pine needles, blades of straw, I now saw the shadows and lines that were sinews and bones of pictures yet to be drawn. When I say that henna is the soul of my book, what I mean is that it provides a deep well of memory and metaphor. Henna helps both my characters and me express what is otherwise inexpressible. In my novel, henna is what ties people together, but it's also what tears them apart. Henna swirls through the narrative, and there are times when henna becomes a language that can speak of love and break a heart. There. That's a little bit about the soul of my book. So now you have story and you have soul. What's left for an author to speak about? I'm going to finish up by speaking about curiosity. People pick up books for so many reasons. To escape, to pass the time, because the cover looks interesting, because the book was suggested to you by a friend, to learn about a new culture. These are all very good reasons to pick up a book and to begin reading. But why do we keep reading? I think that we keep reading primarily for one very important reason. I think that we keep reading a novel because our curiosity has been piqued. Because once we meet the characters on those first pages, we become curious about their lives, about what's going to happen to them, about what already happened to them. In other words, we keep reading because we become deeply invested in the fate of imaginary people. We want the answers to questions about the characters' pasts and future. So now that I've told you a little bit about the story and soul of my book, I will pique your curiosity and give you a sampling of the questions that you will find once you start reading. From the very beginning of Henna House, you meet a character named the Confiscator. I guess you can guess what he does for a living. He comes into Adela's father's shoe shop on the very first page. Will Adela be confiscated? And if not, what saves her from his clutches? A groom engaged to one of my main characters dies under mysterious circumstances in Henna House. Was this man murdered, or did he die of natural causes? And if he was killed, who did it? What do women talk about amongst themselves when they do henna? What kind of stories do they tell? What kind of secrets do they share? What is in Hani's little traveling pouch? There is a secret code in Henna House. Who writes it and why? There is a devastating betrayal in my book. Who betrays whom? What happens to them when they are discovered? And how does the betrayal ultimately ripple outward in the lives of all my characters, causing some to perish and others to thrive? There. I will leave you with those questions. Hopefully, I've piqued your interest in Henna House. I love answering reader questions, and you can find me on Facebook or through my website. I love meeting with book clubs, as you heard, and I've already met with 125 before this night. Feel free to contact me about your book club, as well as about Drexel Story Lab. I teach fiction writing to adults on evenings and weekends, so if you're interested in writing your own stories, if you're interested in talking about the story and soul of fiction, come and play with me. Thank you so much for coming tonight.
Good evening. I'm so excited to be here. I'm very honored. I live here in Philadelphia, and I remember coming to see Kazuo Ishiguro, where we had to make it through the sleet and the snow. So this is a much nicer night. Thank you all for coming. I live here, as I said, in Philadelphia. I co-host the Tire Fire reading series, which offers a platform for fiction writers. And most recently, we've had Kelly Link, Roxane Gay, as well as some upcoming writers. I also have a background in urban education, so I work for the nonprofit Philadelphia Futures. If you've ever heard of them, we do a lot of college access with youth here in Philadelphia. And for me, that work is as much a calling as the work I do as a writer. And in part, I think there's a relationship because I was first generation to college. I'm also an immigrant, and this book very much is an immigrant's story, an immigrant's narrative. As Andrew was mentioning, there is a patriarch, a very proud, fierce Greek patriarch in this book that he forces his way into things, so I'll be reading a little bit of his perspective to you tonight. And he believes he's going to die in 10 days. He has a prophetic dream. He believes he's the kind of man who can have a prophetic dream. And he writes an email to his daughters and his ex-wife explaining how they're failing at life and what they need to do about it. But he disappears before those 10 days are up. And the rest of the book, much of the book, is these daughters trying to understand what has become of their father. I can give you maybe a little bit of insight beyond that introduction. There's a lot of food in this book. I love food. I love food like it might as well be a person. That's how much I love food. It's a big part of my life experience and culture and heritage. And one of my main characters, the oldest daughter, Stavroula, lives out my fantasy of being a chef. I don't have that much experience in doing food prep, but I was trained a little bit when I was younger. This is also a book about translation because these characters have trouble understanding one another as we do in families. We can come from the same stock or the same roots and have no idea what we're saying to one another. And so that's a big part of what this book is occupied with. There are quite a few Greek idioms that I'll share with you just for fun. One is "Efaga ton kosmon na sevro," which means "I ate the whole world to find you." It's just a very dramatic Greek way of saying I've been looking everywhere for you, but we can never do things small. We sort of do high volume. another one that Stavros likes to say often is you put my 2 feet in one shoe, which is another way of saying he's in a tight spot. Perhaps my favorite is do you want me to smell my fingers, which is a very colorful way of saying do you think I'm a mind reader? And it actually comes down from ancient Greece when people used to bet on the Olympic Games. And they'd go see the sort of oracles and find out, you know, is this a good athlete to bet on? And the oracle, they would take a drink of something liquor-based and dip their fingers in this wax and then go into a spell and then smell their fingers and then come back with their prediction. I don't know. I'm not sure why it's gone out of favor. I feel like that should come back. So I would love to just read for you the opening of the novel. What Nami was saying about curiosity really struck me, and I think that that's something that maybe hangs over all of our work as writers, and it's the great stuff of life. It sort of binds us all. So I'm just going to read the first few pages. All you really need to know is that it's an email. It's an email form, and again, it's to his daughters and his ex-wife. From Steve Stavros Mavrakis, Greek Boss 1 at yahoo.com. Subject: Our father who is dying in 10 days. Dear family, daughters, and ex-wife, let me explain you something. I'm sick in a way that no doctor would have much understanding. I'm sick in a way of the soul that, yes, God will take me. No, I am not a suicide. I am deeper than that. I am talking more than that. Dear Stavrula, my oldest, please grow out your hair. It is very, very short. This is one little thing that can change everything. You will see what I am saying when you take this small but substantial advice. Sometimes if we are who we are supposed to be on the outside, we are who we are supposed to be on the inside. The hair is the thing to trust and leave alone, and it will take care of you. Let me explain you something. Your father has seen some of the world for it to be enough. There is a way to be for the normal society, and you are not in it. The hair says things about you that, yes, they are true, but the hair is not a fortune teller. The hair is not the thing that has to point the way, like a street light. I am not somebody religious, but this I know. Death is coming. In 10 days, I promise you, your father, the man, will cease. He will be dust. He will be food in the worms. What do we owe our father? This is the question you can say to yourself at this time. Who can deny a dead man, a dead father, the thing that he demands? Dear Lita, my second, please go to church. You could say, no, Dad, you go to church. Then we will talk about it if I go to church. But what I am talking about here are lessons that I should have taken for myself if my father had the wisdom to give me awareness, which I am holding out for you. Litsa, let me explain you something. Litsa, you have problems. Litsa, nobody marries for a big wedding and then divorce 1 week later. When your mother and I divorce, it took years off our life. Litsa, nobody destroys property the way when you come here into my diner and smash the dessert case with my own stool. The same is true for your sister, which you take that same stool and break her car window with it, even though you deny this always. Are you on drugs, Litsa? Are you the same lowlife as your biological mother, Dina? Litsa, you need God in your life. Litsa, I see how much helping you are needing, and I know that God has to exist because he is the only one who can do for you. I cannot do for you. I can only do for you what I am done for you. And here I will tell you this secret, that I have questions for God. Are you real? Are you here for me, Stavros Stavros Steve Mavrakis? Am I your forgotten son? What is the meaning of this life that is too sorry for what it could be, even though I have succeeded more, much more than any foreigner would do in my country, and I have now 2 diners and plans for selling one of them so that I have a little something for the future. Yours, not mine, since my future is not something I can belong to any longer, and not your mother, since she is a thief. I'm sorry if it is a truth. I, Stavros Stavros, have asked God to erase the mistakes of my life, and God has answered in a matter of speaking that it is best to start over, which requires foremost that we end all that is Stavros Stavros. No, not with suicide, with mercy. Yes, Litsa, you must go to church to pray. For your father, yes, and for yourself. Dear Ruby, my little one that I have adoration, it is a good rule to follow that if the mustache is weak, so will be the man. Look at your father's mustache, which it is a fist. Forget the boys, Ruby. Find yourself a man who encourages you get your own education because you don't want to be one of those women who takes and takes and does not appreciate all of the way her husband slaves, like your mother. Don't go marrying some losers, which you know I am talking about Dave. Why choose a man with the facial hair of an onion when you can choose instead one of my assistant cooks who make a decent living and has dreams of owning their own diner the way their mentor has, which is your father? Otherwise, you are doing okay. Dearest my ex-wife, Carol, the mother, who divorced me 1 year ago, which I am still, as a generous person, paying for things like to repair the plumbing. I'm talking to the woman who is still my wife in death, even if she did not know how to mourn me in life. Please be the ex-wife a wife should be in sickness and health. Even though you poisoned Stavrula and Lita against me from the moment I bring them into this fat country, and Ruby from the moment you bring her into the world. This is why I'm asking you should wear only black for the next year, to show a sign of honor for the man who walked much of this life with you by his side. If you have any confusions, daughters and wife, you can email a response. I will answer them all. Such as, what is missing for a man at the end of his life when the path is clear and wisdom is the greatest? The respect and love for the pateras. Signed, within 10 days of life left, and a dying promise, your father, Stavros Stavros, Steve Mavrakis. Thank you.
I'm Victoria Shore, and my book is set in a part of Brazil that's nothing like what you're thinking of if you think about Brazil. We're thinking of palm trees, or we're thinking of the Amazon, beautiful beaches. This is a dark, deep inland of Brazil. I used to get there by flying to either Salvador and Bahia and then driving for a day on a bad road getting worse until suddenly I was in the kind of place that looked like something from the Bible, and I felt like I could draw a circle around myself like Jesus did and sit there and cast out my own demons. It was a magical place, very, very different and strange. And this is where my book is set. This is a true story about some bandits who lived in the 20s and 30s in this area, which is as big as Spain. None of my friends, I lived in Brazil for 10 years. And when I first got interested in these bandits, I wanted to travel out there, but no one would go. No one was the slightest bit interested. I finally got out there. I found a photographer who was traveling. I knew her daughter. We started traveling out there, and it turned out to be just as beautiful and wonderful as I wanted to go, as I was hoping it would be. Everything in my book, even though it's called a fiction, the book is true. Everything in it is true. It's just that in order to tell the story, I had to go into the minds of the characters, and that's what makes it into a fiction. But there's nothing in it that I didn't learn from people out in the sertão of Brazil. But everyone in Brazil knows who these characters are. There were a group of bandits that were written about at the time when they were alive, lots of photographs of them, lots of newspaper stories, even a movie with some footage. But what interested me was their song. I heard a street guard singing it when I was living in São Paulo. It goes, "You teach me to make lace to the women of the region, and I'll teach you to make love." I was amazed, a bandit singing about lace and love. "Yeah," said the guard, "it was his marching song to the women up there. They make lace even now." It was really late at night. And we had been come back from a costume party dressed as the bandits when he started singing this song. Lace and love, was it possible? I really didn't want to just write about criminals. I was intrigued, though. I heard that there was actually some moving footage of the bandits, and I managed to go and see it. I saw the movie, and it was just extraordinary. There they were in this very strange-looking region. And at the end of the movie, there was a poem that this bandit had written to the love of his life, Maria Bonita. It starts, "I too have had my loves." And then I was hooked. What I found was a story of passion and love, people who were willing for love to leave comfortable lives, go out and face what would be certain death, but for the sake of this passionate, amazing life while it lasted. They had a saying, "To die in a gunfight is to die happy." That was bravura, you know. It was also terrifying. They had it both, the passion and the terror. And that's really what this book is about. It was funny, just one tale before I do a short reading. The night before I went out the first time into the sertão, I met a man, a scholar in Salvador, in Bahia, who had traveled with Mario Vargas Llosa, had written a book out there called The War of the End of the World. And he said, well, you've got boots, don't you, and jeans, you know, and it was very hot up there. And I thought, boots, jeans, we had thin trousers and flip-flops. He goes, no, there's snakes, and you've got to take talcum powder because the boots are so, the jeans are so hot, you know. And how about a driver? And I said, a driver? And they go, yeah, two women alone out there? My God, that's too frightening. They're bandits still. Turned out, we were never frightened. We never saw any snakes, and we had no need of talcum powder because we weren't wearing jeans. So, I want to read a short piece about the bandit Maria Bonita. Before she was Maria Bonita, before she married the bandit prince, whose name was Lampion, she had been married at age 16 by her father during one of the regional droughts to a shoemaker, that an old man whom she didn't love or even like. They barely even spoke to each other. She had been married to him for 6 years. She was 22. She slept alone at night in her hammock. It was a very sad and desperate existence. That night, she lay alone in her hammock, wondering about the werewolf she'd heard who had come to their cousin's house about a week ago. Her aunt and her uncle had walked out to a funeral, and the children were there alone, but they were old enough to bring in the goats and to remember to heft the heavy bar across the door. But it almost didn't matter. He almost broke it down anyway. They'd woken to the sound of his howling, his clawing, his panting, and crawled together into the farthest corner and watched the door heave. All night long it went on, the howling and the clawing, though once in a while it would let up and they'd hear a commotion among the chickens. But then he'd come back, and the only question was whether the door would hold till dawn. They'd heard that he couldn't stand even one ray of sunshine, and it must have been true, because he was no longer there when their parents came back the next morning into the yard with the dead chickens scattered all around, and the house still locked and barred, and the children still in the corner, but safe, alive. The priest came out afterwards with holy water, and everyone came by to stare at the gashes in the door. And one old tracker said it was the work of a jaguar, but the children were adamant. It was the wolf man. They'd heard him clearly, even if they hadn't had to look in his terrible face. But what would have happened next, she wondered, not to the children, but to her, if he came in here? What would he do? Would there be love before the murder? He was a wolf, but he was a man, too. Which was he more, wolf or man? She walked over to the shutters, closed tight, as everyone's were, every door and shutter in the whole Sertón, shut and barred before nightfall. The nights were filled with dangers, werewolves, bandits, terrors all, to be shut out. But what was she afraid of? Really, what was she afraid of anymore? She threw open the shutters and whispered to the night, I want. But want what? She didn't know until the day she saw the bandits' gun belts on her husband's workshop and knife sheaths 20 inches long. Now we fast forward to 4 years when Maria Bonita had run off with the bandits. She'd gone off with Lampion, and she'd lived for 4 years, and it had been a really dreamy, amazing, wonderful 4 years. They'd gone into villages the way the bandits did. People would receive them. The police were always fighting with them, but they would very often flee if they knew they were coming, in which case they'd enter a town, have a beautiful dance for the people. They would take money from the rich, they would buy things, and that had been their life. But now, the part I'm going to read is after they'd had the first encounter where she actually faced death, where they thought they were going to die. They were surrounded by militias from three different states, and only the bandits' strategy, really his Lampion's great strategic sense, had saved them. It was a lot of luck. It was skill, but they could have died out there, and it was the first time she'd really faced it. It was a famous victory for the bandits. and written up as such in all the newspapers, Lampion was pronounced invincible. But it was shortly after that that the dream started. Maria Bonita would awake in a sweat, in tears. Some soldiers were after her with their knives, and Lampion wasn't there. Usually she'd awake and he'd be in the tent and put his arms around her and tell her it would never happen and to go back to sleep. But one night, he wasn't in the tent when she woke, and she was too shaken. It had been too vivid, too real. Her heart was pounding, and she pulled a skin around her shoulders and crawled outside. It was still dark, and the camp was quiet, but one of the bandits, her friend, Luis Pedro, was sitting by the fire. He had the last watch, which meant that night was almost over. She walked over and sat beside him. "I had a dream," she started. He looked up at her and smiled. "Yeah, the dreams." Which meant what? She wasn't sure. She picked up a stick and poked at the embers, glowing red with a little flame now and then. What it didn't mean, though, was tell me, since the last thing Luis Pedro needed were her bad dreams, or her confession, that she'd been badly frightened out there in Marandubá. What could that mean to him? That she'd been a child till then, a poser, strutting through towns with her gun belt, but so scared the first time it really came to it that she was ready to beg for her life, beg and bargain if the soldiers gave her a chance to talk? And what of it now anyway? It wasn't as if she could quit and go home, explain to the police and judges that it had all been very nice when it was singing and dancing and looting. But now that she'd seen the other side of it, smelled it, lived it, and now dreamt it, she'd come to understand that perhaps she'd made a mistake. And had she? Wasn't she alive and well that day, that night, that early morning? Hadn't she and Lampion fallen back into each other's arms after Marandubá with more passion than ever? And if she was, in fact, unworthy, if she'd betrayed him in her heart that day, in her fear, her thoughts were hidden, and who knew what anyone was ever thinking, dreaming? Who knew their secret fears? She looked up at Luis Pedro. "Roll me a cigarette?" She'd never smoked before, but as soon as she said it, she knew it was the thing. He hesitated. "The captain won't like it." It was true. Lampion didn't like women to smoke. But truer still that if the police hadn't been just that, monkeys, if Mané Neto hadn't played such a perfect fool, then not even Lampion could have saved her out there under that sun in Marandubá. There would have come that moment when she would have found herself standing there absolutely alone. "Come on," she said to Luis Pedro, and he shrugged and took out his tobacco. What could he do? She was Maria Bonita. Because there was that, too. She was queen out here. While she lived, she was queen. Luis Pedro rolled her a cigarette in a corn husk, lit it and handed it to her. She inhaled too hard and coughed. Laughed. He laughed. She took another puff, easier this time. "So that's how you do it, like that. How funny, how crazy. And what would Lampion say?" But what could he say, though? Because the truth was, if she was going to die young out there anyway, the least she could do was smoke.
Thank you again to these three ladies for their wonderful readings and discussions. If we could have another round of applause. I thought maybe I'd jumpstart the conversation with a first question, and the question that occurred to me looking through the books and reading through them was, the uniqueness of all the voices. And I wonder if you could each talk to or speak about how you came to the voice of your book, or the voices in some cases.
For me, characters, I get to know my characters when they open their mouths. So my character's voice comes to me through dialogue. And it's really only once they speak to other people in the narrative that I know who they are. And that's no matter what I'm writing, and it certainly was true for Henna House. So short and sweet, but for me it's definitely through dialogue.
Annie?
That's interesting. I actually, if I don't know how they talk, I also don't know them. And my character, Stavros, in the beginning, I mean, he's so big and sort of foreboding, and in the beginning, he didn't have any humor. which made him like a big weight on the novel. And it wasn't until I hit that phrase, "let me explain you," that I understood the register of his voice. But the challenge then became that much of the book is told in his perspective, but then it's also told in two of his daughters' perspectives as well. And I just had to throw out hundreds of pages because their voices could not serve as a counterweight. He was such a sort of colonizing presence in the book and for his author too. But in terms of where his voice, the piece that I shared with you, where his voice came from, my parents immigrated. My biological parents were in an arranged marriage. And my father and stepmom, my mom, raised me. But I had been around plenty of immigrants growing up, and there's a kind of poetry, actually, to English as a second language. So I think I probably just took a lot of that in and, you know, ultimately was able to harness some of it to create his voice.
Victoria?
I really don't know how to answer that.
Fair enough.
It's almost a mystery.
Okay. Well, I'm sure there are other mysteries, and perhaps you want to know the answers. If anybody in the audience has a question, if you raise your hand, we will send a microphone your way. Who would like to ask a question? Gentleman, all the way in back there.
I just want to ask, let's say if I did have a story, because I was listening about the werewolf. I didn't really hear it because I was kind of off and on, like halfway here and then daydream. I want to know, if I had like if I want to write a story like a comic or anything, is there any availability that you could teach me in some kind of way or the part? I don't know how to explain it.
Well, I think what you want to do is enroll in a writing class somewhere, and that'll get you started.
Are you local here? Are you in Philadelphia? There's a lot of really great resources, actually. Philadelphia is a really great city for that. And actually, Naomi was talking about one of her workshops.
Yeah, you should come play with me in Story Lab.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that when I was first starting out, community was a really big thing. You know, getting some like-minded people, where, you know, whether that's at the library or formally with a course or just some people you know, because just having trusted readers can be really, really important.
I agree.
I originally came here for Naomi, and I'm so glad I heard the other two books because I definitely want to read them. But I've read both of your books, and I truly love them. In fact, yesterday I was at the beach and got a henna to the dismay of my daughter. But I just became so intrigued with the whole idea of henna and the Jews. I had didn't know anything about it. I've read a lot of Jewish literature. I'm really into it. So how did you decide to write about the Yemenites? Because it's not something that a lot of people know about. Thank you.
Well, we'll have to look at your henna afterwards. We'll have to admire it. As a writer, I gravitate towards stories that haven't been told often. And so I really look for that story that, oh, you know, we don't know about that, so let me look into that. But in terms of my own connection to this story, I'm not a Yemenite Jew, but I do have a family connection to a beloved aunt who is a Yemenite Jew, and I grew interested in her history and culture and started to research it and quickly found henna. And I was just fascinated, and I fell down a rabbit hole. I just had to learn more. So it really was first through a family connection, and then I just grew intrigued. But I just want to say one more thing, and I have a feeling that my fellow writers are the same. You can tell me. But if I'm not learning something while I'm writing, I get really bored with my work. And so I almost purposefully write about subjects that I don't know a lot about. So I have to research and learn, and so it keeps me engaged in my own work, and that's part of an answer to your question. Yeah, do you feel the same way? Do you? Yeah.
I would like to know more about your living in Brazil for 10 years or 8 years, whichever it was. That is a fascinating idea that I would like to know more about.
Well, I was living in New York through the 70s and 80s. And
yeah, you're fine. Just hold it to your mouth.
And I had traveled in South America in the early 70s. And some friends in New York actually were Brazilian, and they invited us down, supposedly for 1 year, to see some exploration of the Amazon that they were doing. And once we got down there, Brazil is such a wonderful place. It just was magical. And we had put all our stuff in storage. We'd gone down there with a one-year-old child, but, you know, before we knew it, there were two more children, and a whole group of wonderful friends. We had to learn Portuguese, which was very difficult. You know, I'd gotten A's in French in school, and I thought, terrific, but nothing doing. It really was a different thing. And then the longer I was down there, and the better I could speak Portuguese, the more intrigued by the culture. It's very different from going to Europe and sort of connecting to something that we already know. Brazil has a whole different starting point, you know. They're not, they weren't puritanical. They like differences among people. They're not prejudiced against other people. They like people to be different. No one changes their name in Brazil. Things are much more interracial. It's just like having a weight taken off your back to get down there. It's really fun, you know, and they're really nice. So we ended up staying. I got involved in this project, and once I started this project, I took four different trips up there, four long trips into the Sertão. It was hard to get there. You know, you have to fly and drive, and luckily I met a woman who was also interested, a photographer, in traveling up there. And we never saw another car in four trips. We would get to a village, and people would go, look at the woman driving. You know, they'd never seen such a thing. And that's where we found all our stories. So the longer we stayed, then there just came a moment. We had children we were bringing up, and we just thought we had to move back to America. But it was hard, because Brazil was a wonderful place, and I really look forward to going back.
What was it about the story that kept reeling you in? So that you needed to write about it.
About the story.
Yeah.
Well, when I, you know, the bandit thing is always interesting, but when I heard the song, which really, you know, you teach me to make lace and I'll teach you to make love, that was so, it was both courteous and appealing, you know, attractive. And then when I read the poetry, I thought, these people are really different from us, you know, from what we know, what you said, something that you don't know that was different. And when I was traveling up there, every village that I went to, people still remembered the bandits. So that's where I got all my stories, from people in these villages. It was incredible. You know, we would sort of roll into a dusty village, and people would come up and want to talk about the band. You know, we would start asking, and then they would tell so-and-so and send for so-and-so. And it was really amazing that way.
It's interesting. I mean, it seems like many cultures like to lionize the bandit, the outsider. I just think of this culture's love for the mafia, etc.
You know, these people were seeking justice. That's the other thing, and I think I really did neglect to say that. This bandit leader was a rancher. He was not. He wasn't seeking to be a criminal. His father was murdered by the neighbors in a family feud. He went to court to get justice. The judge said to him, your father's dead. There's nothing we can do for him. But the people who killed him are alive. They can come back and kill us. You'll have to leave justice to God. Now, that's the way it was in the Sertão, to this day even. You have to leave justice to God. But there's some people who won't do that. And he was one of those people. He was not willing to leave justice to God. He thought he was just going to go out and kill the guys who killed his father and go home. But he was too good at it. You know, before long, he had 100 guys who had their own their own justice issues with him, and then it was too late. And then the women started joining the band, and then it was a real culture.
Hi, is there any meaning to the names you chosen for your characters?
Oh, that's a fun question. Do you want to go first?
Sure. Stavros is a very common Greek name. I have probably 15 cousins named Stavros. The eldest daughter is named Stavrula because it was the father's bid to he wanted sons. And so it was the closest he was going to get to a son, was naming his daughter after him. And I think, in fact, I've pulled quite a few names from extended family. But then there were sort of, there's one character named Hero, which is a Greek name, but has just great connotations. There's a character named Tasso, and Greek names are really fun. They're very tonal, I guess, you know, they're sort of textural. And his last name, Marakis, the Akis is sort of a holdover from occupation, and it means, it's diminutive for like little, and that sort of shaped his character as well. He's always resisting. He's sort of short, as many Greek men are, and he's sort of resisting a lot of the that kind of impulse placed on him.
I'll go next. So I love naming characters. It's one of my favorite things to do because, I mean, I have three kids, so I could only name three kids. But you have so many characters, so you get to pick out names, and it's truly one of my favorite things when a new character walks onto the page and I get to name them. And I do it in a variety of ways. I look at lists of names from, you know, that, in this case, Yemenite Jewish culture, and I'll pick out one that just has a nice sound or an interesting, generally it's sound, because the sound quality of my words is very important to me, the music that the words make. And so I'll pick out names by how many syllables they have. Maybe I'm looking for a four-syllable name or a five-syllable name or a two-syllable name, and because I want it to sound a certain way in a sentence. And with my main character, Adela, that was really important for me because I wanted a three-syllable name. Because on the very first page of the book, the confiscator walks into her father's shop and says her name in a very slow way. He says, Adela, and he drags it out. And in my mind, that was a real echo of Lolita, of Nabokov's Lolita. And I really wanted a three-syllable name to echo that because Lolita, it's a book about many things, but one thing it's about is this child who forced to into a sexualized situation that she shouldn't be, just like my character is, because of the orphan's decree. And so I very consciously chose a three-syllable name for that echo. So it wasn't the meaning that was important to me, it was the syllables and the music quality of the word.
And Victoria, you were sort of trapped with history, weren't you, once you made your selection? Another question or two before we wrap up.
I don't know. I know that Annie went to Syracuse, but I don't know if you guys have done writing programs. Do you think it's worth it to remove yourself from the world to write?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Can you discuss how that helped shape your writing process? Sure.
The first thing I'd say, though, I guess a caveat, which is there are a lot of writing programs that charge a lot of money, and so that's a really personal decision. I was lucky because Syracuse offers a fellowship. For me, it was kind of a game changer because, as I mentioned, I was first generation of college. I've sort of been taught as an immigrant that work means certain things, and writing doesn't always sort of qualify as work. It's not the same kind of productivity as other kinds of work. And I've internalized that, and I work very hard at my job, and I believe in what I do in urban education, and so I needed the time and space to be able to develop this, or else I just don't think I would have been able to. I was really lucky to work with George Saunders at Syracuse, and so if you decide that this is for you, it's great to find the people whose work really excites you. I remember him saying in one of the early classes that it's our responsibility to write joy as well as pain, and I think that really stayed with me and shaped this book. And all of a sudden, I was sort of opening myself up to the range of human experience in a way I'd never been able to do before. I realized I could be funny on the page. I'd never known that that was even a remote possibility. You know, so, I mean, I think that we offer patronage and apprenticeship in a lot of different areas and disciplines, and writing needs to be one of those as well. But it, you know, if you have family or a career or it's hard to get to sort of become uprooted, I think it's a very personal decision. But I can say that I'm so grateful for the community and the cohort that I found.
Just to add a different perspective, I didn't do that, but and I mostly found my own way, but I found also tremendous help in reading the Paris Review interviews with writers. They're just, they're so insightful, and they're also very, they give you courage in the dark, they really do, and they show you ways of holding on and from people that you really respect, so.
I went to Brown for my MFA, and I completely agree with both of everything both of you just said. And, you know, all of my friends after I graduated college were going on to graduate school or were working. So they were in medical school or law school or graduate school or whatever. And for me, going to get an MFA was a really great way not to be lost because I didn't really feel like I had an alternative. I knew I wanted to write. I knew I needed to write. And at Brown, I also had a fellowship. So to have a place that would like care for and feed me while I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and was really, really important for me. But I think that beyond that, you know, just finding a community and finding supportive voices, whether they're in a non-traditional workshop or in a literary magazine, to know that you're not alone, that's really, really important. So, yeah.
So it sounds like finding community is essential if you're going to be a writer. And courage in the dark, what a wonderful phrase. Please join me in thanking Nomi Eve, Annie Leontes, and Victoria Shore. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.